ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit LeggMason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, this week it's a best of ETF Prime. We're going to replay some of our favorite conversations from over the past several months. As always, I'd like to thank the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime, Legg Mason. We're going to start with a conversation I had with ETF.com's Dave Nodig. Back in January, the investment world lost a legend when Vanguard founder Jack Bogle passed away at the age of 89. And we said at the time, and I think this sentiment is shared by most investors, whether you're an advocate for passive investing, active management, maybe you fall somewhere in between, I think most people agree nobody did more for everyday investors than Jack did, especially when it comes to lowering investment costs. So Dave and I looked back at Jack's legacy. We talked about his complicated relationship with ETFs. And what I really liked about this conversation was we also discussed the future of investment management. Take a listen. Dave, obviously we're paying tribute to Jack Bogle on today's show, and you wrote a really nice piece last week, I thought appropriately titled Saint Jack, by the way, but you talked about how much Jack meant to your own career. I thought we could maybe start there. When did you first come across Jack Bogle's work, and what was it that resonated with you?
I think like most folks, I discovered indexing and quant finance and Jack Bogle and Ben Graham all at the same time, right? Just as I was learning about investing, maybe in the 80s, really, honestly. And, I didn't get a chance to meet the man until well into my career, maybe in the late 90s, and really didn't have many interactions with him. But I think it's safe to say he really acted as sort of a stake in the ground on one way of doing business that I think was inspiring to a lot of us.
What was that opportunity like, having a chance to meet him in person? That's something that I've never had an opportunity to do. We'll certainly always regret that. But what was that experience like?
Well, I think one of the great things about Bogle was that he was actually remarkably available. He would talk to college students who would call him up on, doing research papers. One of the things you'll see if you just Google him is that he shows up everywhere. He shows up in school newspapers. He shows up on CNBC. He shows up in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. He really was willing to talk to anybody about the things he was passionate about. And that was always just that individual investor. And, my personal experiences with him were pretty minimal. I wrote about in my article sort of one, sort of long interaction I had with him in a green room ahead of an event. And he was just the most humble, natural, easy to speak to guy you'd ever meet. I mean, in some ways, he was like the parish priest of investment management.
Well, to your point, just looking at Twitter last week, I was absolutely amazed at how many people had pictures with Jack or personal anecdotes of meeting him. And Connor and I were actually talking about this a little bit earlier, but do you think that's one of the reasons his message resonated so well, just that people saw him as an everyday person, and so they could relate. Perhaps they didn't feel like they were being sold something.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was never anybody less of a salesman than Jack Bogle. And in fact, towards the end of his career, the last 10 years, he actually sort of made it his job to be a thorn in the side of those of us in the industry, and I'll put myself in the same box, that we're selling things, that we're out there trying to invent better mousetraps or sort of further the evolution. He really believed, I think, until his dying days, that the better mousetrap had been found and the problems had been solved. And he would quite often go off on, you know, the same kinds of things we talk about, the proliferation of new ETF strategies, about ETFs being things that engendered trading, about the problems of too much money following the same strategies. He did not go quietly into that good night, that's for sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because it's pretty well documented. Jack had, I think we'll say, a complicated relationship with ETFs. Some may even say a love-hate, probably more hate. And I think to your point, he certainly appreciated broad index ETFs, but he didn't like the fact that ETFs could be traded intraday. He had heartburn over all of the different ways markets are being sliced and diced with ETFs. Of course, Vanguard famously didn't offer ETFs until after Bogle left the company.
Yeah.
So what was your overall impression of his views on ETFs?
Well, I mean, that one big interaction I had with him and the work that he did speaking at our Journal of Indexes editorial events, he very much felt that the packaging mattered, right? That the core idea of low-cost indexing was great, but that it could be used for ill, that it was, you know, as it were, a sharp tool. And he was just not bashful about putting that out there. I mean, he really tried to get people to focus not on the theoretical returns of products, but on how people actually use them, how actual investors use products. And the research he was doing right up till the very end was about how the actual holders of products experience their own personal returns. And so by that case, you know, if you look at the average holding period of ETFs, it's not a lifetime. It's much shorter than that, because there are so many people who use ETFs as trading vehicles, even while many of us use them as real long-term buy and hold vehicles.
Well, I actually came across a quote in the Wall Street Journal. This was from several years back, where Jack said ETFs were like a shotgun, great for hunting, but also excellent for suicide. I mean, you know, Jack always had
correct.
A certain way with words.
Yeah.
Do you think Jack saw ETFs as sort of his Frankenstein? You know, he launched the first index mutual fund, which was obviously the predecessor to ETFs. Do you think that turned into a monster in his eyes?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was part of the reason he spent so much of the last 15 years really trying to educate people about the double-edged sword nature of easy access to things, whether that was simply the easy access to the tools of indexing to make, long, short, buy and hold strategies that he always sort of lambasted, or just, simply that by giving people so many choices, we forgot some of the Ben Graham-ness, right? I mean, he was always fond of talking about Ben Graham's core strategy of you really only need two things. You just need access to bonds, you need access to equities, and you should be weighting those between 25 and 75, and you're done. And that simplicity, I think, has a real appeal. And the honest truth is, I think, as we would all agree, the vast majority of investors would, in fact, be better off doing less.
I know you're extremely well-schooled in ETF history, and Jack actually turned down an opportunity to partner on the first ETF, SPY, with Nate Most. And some view that as a pretty big mistake at the time. Of course, Vanguard has, I think, recovered pretty well. But do you have any insight into sort of the internal wrestling at Vanguard, even after Jack left, around their decision to launch ETFs, just given how large of a shadow Jack had cast?
Yeah, I mean, I think Vanguard has wrestled with its unique structure over and over again, right? I mean, its mutual nature, where it's owned by its shareholders, is obviously wonderful for doing things like maintaining costs and sort of keeping a certain ethical set of guideposts, right? You never have to worry about what the right thing to do is, because you just ask what you would do as a shareholder. So there is a certain cleanliness to that, but it makes innovation really challenging, because you know, at some point somebody says, hey, I have a crazy new idea and I need $100 million to go chase it. It's tough to do that if your only guidepost is what's the best thing for my existing shareholder. And I think the launch of ETFs was largely about that, right? What to what advantage, you know, who is going to get an advantage if I was just a, you know, a Vanguard mutual fund holder for launching this whole new ETF business, right? And I think now we can look back on it and say, actually, there have been some fantastic advantages even for those existing Vanguard mutual fund shareholders in terms of growing the asset base, lowering expenses, and managing taxes. So there have been big advantages, but I think they were hard to see at the time.
Well, and it's interesting to your point, even today, Vanguard is still very meticulous with new ETF launches, right? They're not, they're certainly not throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. So as we look forward here, as I'm sure you saw, Jack wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal towards the end of last year where he expressed concern that indexing had maybe grown too much. And I think he was most concerned that if a few large fund companies control nearly every U.S. company, that might cause some issues as it relates to corporate governance. Do you view that as a concern?
I think it is actually one of the big stories that will, frankly, probably dominate the rest of my career, right? The next 10 or 15 years. I think we're going to be talking a lot about this. I think the math behind sort of low-cost, large-scale passive indexing is inexorable. And so we're going to only see more of what we've seen, which is more and more concentration and a handful of players. It's also true that economies of scale in this type of business are extremely important. So it's unlikely we're just going to magically have 25 new indexes, 25 new index competitors that somehow usurp the dominance of both the traditional index providers, the S&Ps, the MSCIs, the FTSE Russells, or those firms that are leaning on those indexes, the BlackRock's, Vanguard, State Streets of the world. So this is going to be a real issue we discuss. Now, I happen to think that there are real ways to solve this, that we can use technology to, for lack of a better term, pull the intents of the investor base of these large firms and actually bring people back into corporate governance. I think it's a bit of a myth to think that, you know, active mutual fund shareholders are somehow paying a lot of attention to how their fund managers are voting proxies now either. So I actually think that we have a lot of really interesting ways to engage investors in governance in new and interesting ways, and to look through the shield of the index mutual fund or the index ETF to get at those things. So I think it's a solvable problem, but it is one I think we're going to hear a lot more about.
Well, I think one other solution that's been proposed, I think Jack mentioned this in his op-ed, and it's easier said than done, but it's simply more competition, right? Don't just let Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street run roughshod. And I know Jack has actually mentioned that he thinks other companies may need to adopt Vanguard's mutual ownership structure to compete because it's such a competitive advantage. I guess, one, do you agree with that? And then two, why hasn't anyone tried to go that route? Why let Vanguard monopolize the mutual structure?
Well, I mean, the mutual structure isn't a completely brand new idea. It's only new in the asset management context, right? I mean, we have regional banks and savings and loans and credit unions and insurance companies have all taken their tilt at this particular windmill. The problem is it's not a particularly efficient strategy for innovation or for capital allocation. It's a great structure for running an ongoing business. And so, you know, you pointed out that Vanguard tends to be very slow to do new things. Part of that is because of this. And so when we talk about people coming out and competing, it's extremely unlikely to me that that's going to come from any kind of a mutual structure because it doesn't reward that kind of risk-taking. Capitalism tends to reward that kind of risk-taking. So while I agree more competition would, if it existed, help ameliorate some of those concerns, I don't see that actually happening. I actually see the opposite happening. I see more concentration at the top. I think we'll have lots of smaller competitors, but when it comes down to corporate governance, I don't think we're going to compete our way out of having a handful of large asset managers who kind of roll up the governance votes for a lot of corporate America.
David's Connor. So we've discussed this on the show previously, but what happens to innovation if there are only four big firms, you know, 10 years from now? You know, that there was, it seemed like the start of the ETF world, the large players focused on the plain vanilla, you know, broad indexing and let the smaller players do what they wanted to in the niche space, right? And then, you know, last couple of years, you get a firm like Robo, you know, that launches a fantastically successful robotics and automation ETF. And all of a sudden, a year later, or a couple of years later, I guess, iShares launches their version of that, right? iRobot, IRBO. And all of a sudden, you're seeing the largest players start getting into these niche segments where the smaller innovator players could actually have some success. And my real concern is what happens down the road if there are only a handful of dominant players, because like you mentioned, at these low margins, right, of handful of basis points, scale is probably the most important aspect of the game in town.
Yeah, I think that the counter argument I'd make to that is, yes, we see, you know, let's pick on BlackRock here for a minute. BlackRock has definitely got, you know, the biggest game in town, yet they're the ones out there, you know, looking at layoffs, right? Because their business has become so big and so multifaceted that even with their dominance in passive and with ETFs, they've sort of gotten too big for their britches and other parts of their businesses had to pull back. And so I think there is a bit of a double-edged sword there. Companies that become very big end up having other kinds of problems, and smaller companies are generally able to be more nimble, to launch new products, to open up new spaces. We saw this with the robo-advisor space too, right? I mean, we saw Wealthfront and Betterment really open up a market, and yeah, then we saw Schwab and Vanguard come in with their approaches that garnered a lot of assets, but it hasn't put Betterment out of business. They're still doing great too.
Dave, do you see any realistic scenario over the next, I don't know, 15, 20 years where somebody becomes a real threat to Vanguard and BlackRock?
You know, we've talked a little bit about it before, but I think the distribution is actually much more important than product design at this point. I don't think anybody's going to innovate their way to the top of the leaderboard with a better version of, you know, a large cap equity index. But I do think players with big established brands, whether they're financial services brands or whether they're internet-based brands, Google, Amazon, folks like that, that have a lot of customer touch and a lot of customer loyalty, I think they could be very disruptive in the investment management and, frankly, in the broad financial services space. So I think the importance of brand and distribution is going to be paramount over the next 10 or 15 years. And that's why I think we're going to see some really interesting moves there. And, you know, I'm not sure whether Jack Bogle would approve of those actions, but I think that's the way we're headed.
All right. So I want to ask you two quick closing questions here on Jack Bogle. First, is there anyone you can think of who's out there right now that can maybe take the torch from Jack and sort of be the everyday investor's advocate?
You know, I had a feeling you were going to ask me that question. I've been racking my brains about it all weekend long, and the honest truth is no. And I think that we're in, some of this is the internet. I think we're in a bit of a post-legend world when it comes to financial services, right? I mean, I don't look around and see a lot of Peter Lynch's and Warren Buffett's and Jack Bogle's as rising stars. Obviously, we have, you know, a handful of portfolio managers that we you know, sort of know and revere and hang on their every word, whether it's, you know, folks like Gundlach or things like that. But in terms of the sort of tireless, selfless advocacy that we've seen out of somebody like Jack Bogle, I think he's a once-in-a-generation kind of guy.
Do you think that's a problem, or do you think Jack's message is out there so well now, it's so ubiquitous, that it's not a problem, that people know what to focus on?
Well, no, it's always a problem, right? I mean, education is never done, right? I mean, I you know, as a fellow media person, I'm sure you get that sense of, like, haven't we talked about this before? And then you go look, and yeah, it was 2 years ago. Well, guess what? 2 years ago is a long time, and every day there are new investors coming to the market. They need to hear these messages over and over again. So I don't think the work is ever done. And so with that context, the loss of Jack Bogle is just a straight-up loss.
All right. And then if you had to boil down Jack Bogle's legacy into just a few words, what would you say?
You know, he said it himself so many better ways. My paraphrase would simply be, keep it simple, stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, the things that I took out of Jack's speeches and his books were almost universally boiled down to, don't overthink and overcomplicate what is a pretty straightforward discussion. There are a lot of nuances. There's a lot of ways to go wrong. But fundamentally, coming back down to that idea of, do the simple things really well, do it cheap, and don't overcomplicate your life. You know, that was the message I took from him, and my one longer interaction with him was, you know, so be a little boring, be a little forgetful, and I think that's a pretty solid message.
Well, Dave, really appreciate you sharing your thoughts on Jack Bogle today. No doubt the investment world has lost a true legend. I don't think any question, nearly every investor is better off because of his efforts. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys.
So that was ETF.com's Dave Nottig. And I agree with Dave. It's hard to envision someone taking the torch from Jack. He was just so unique, truly once in a generation, and no doubt his legacy will live on for a very long time. Now, something we touched on in that conversation was ETF innovation and how a big fund company like Vanguard, with their mutual structure, or BlackRock, just with all of their overhead and costs, they're not really into taking big risks with new ETF launches. And what you'll find is a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of ETF innovation does come from smaller entrepreneurial fund companies who are willing to take those risks. As Dave mentioned, they have the ability to be a bit more nimble. The next conversation we have is with one such fund company, appropriately named Innovator ETFs. They have a lineup of what are called defined outcome ETFs, which offer exposure to the S&P 500, where you have a cap to the upside, but also downside protection. They're the first ETFs of their kind, and they've been a pretty big success story. They launched back in August. There's 9 of these ETFs altogether, and they already have about $375 million invested in them. I was joined by the CEO of Innovator ETFs, Bruce Bond, who I thought did a fantastic job of describing these ETFs in terms everyone can understand. This was a very popular download. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. Bruce, great having you on the program today.
Thank you, Nate, for having me.
Bruce, first, where did you come up with the idea for these ETFs, and why did you think there was a need in the marketplace?
Well, you know, we have a lot of history in the market and looking at ETFs and kind of understanding what investors are interested in. And I think one of my partners here had invested in a annuity that gave him certain protections and kind of guaranteed outcomes. And we got together and talked and said, you know, I mean, why couldn't we provide something like this in an ETF where investors would be more comfortable investing in the equity markets knowing that they had a built-in buffer, but that they would have participation on the upside. And so the more we looked into it, we realized that no one had done it. There were some particulars that we had to figure out, but we were able to, you know, engineer something that really is very elegant, I think, and serves investors well.
All right, so let's maybe have you walk through how these ETFs are constructed, and then we can get into all the details on how investors can best use them. So explain the construction here. What do these hold, and how exactly do they work?
Well, I mean, the one way to think about them is they're very simple. It's like buying the S&P 500 ETF, any S&P 500 ETF. And what they do, though, is that they have a built-in buffer. And there's three different levels of buffers that are provided. One is a 9% buffer. Now, with that 9% buffer, you have a 22%, when they were originally launched here, a 22% cap. And then there's a second fund that has a 15% buffer. It has a 13.9% cap. And then there's a third one that has a 30% buffer. Now, it buffers you between -5 and -35%, and it has a 12% cap. And so that's the way to think about them real simply is, you know, it's buying an S&P 500 ETF with certain built-in buffers. And the greater the buffer, the lower your cap, the less upside you get. And that's really what the cost is, you know, and how they're financed. Now, what they're built out of, each of the ETFs are built using what are called flex options. Flex options are really a very simple way to say a custom option. And there's 6 or 7 options in each of the portfolios. And the reason we use these flex options that are called custom is because we can say, okay, they start on exactly this day, and they end all together at the same time on this day. And by doing that, we're able to give you this particular defined outcome very precisely on a particular day in the future and allows investors to know even before they buy, okay, this is my outcome and what the outcome will be.
And Bruce, to be clear, that outcome, that is point to point. In other words, that defined outcome you will receive if you purchase the ETF on day one.
Exactly. If you purchase it on day one, when the fund resets, and you hold it till the end of the year, and it's really easy to see. If you look at the website, you can see, okay, I'm buying today, and this is the end, you know, like when the options expire. So this is when they would reset, and that would be the period. And I mentioned earlier, you know, these caps are all set on the day that the funds actually came to market. This is a new series of funds, and but that will reset each year. And so you can look at that each day, though, because they move around a little bit, you know, as a basket of options will do in the market. They track closely the S&P 500, but they won't be exactly on top of the S&P 500. You need to hold it over the year, what we call the outcome period. You have to hold it for that entire period, and at the end of that period, you will get the result of what it says. Now, there's some tools that are on the website that you can look on any particular day, and you can say, okay, if I bought today and purchased at this price, this would be my outcome at the end of this outcome period.
What happens at the end of each outcome period? So if I'm an investor holding these for, you know, let's say a few years, at the end of each outcome period, what will the experience be?
What the experience will be at the end of the outcome period is that the portfolio of options, the basket of options, will reset into a new outcome. Now, what changes on the particular outcome is the cap. So, for example, if you bought the 9% buffer, it's approximately 1 year, 365 days.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bought that, it will go out 365 days, would be the end of your new outcome period. You would get a new 9% buffer, depending on what happened in the market. You get a 9% buffer. And then the cap will adjust. Now, the caps move based on the amount of volatility in the market and the dividend. There are several factors that go into determining the cap. But the cap will move around based on the amount of volatility in the market. And typically, the greater the volatility, the greater the cap, which is a good thing. You don't see that with a lot of other risk-type products. I mean, inherently, you would think, well, the more risk, the lower the cap, you know, but actually with these products, it's the opposite of that. That's why when we saw this volatility recently in December, that the cap on the 9%er shot up to 22%, the 20 range, because the greater amount of volatility, the greater cap. It's good for investors as you go into the future, because if you think about it, if you reset, if it's a really volatile market, you'll capture the upside of that market or more of the upside of that market in the following year. So, you know, you're not stuck at 22% every year or 13% or 12% every year. You know, those caps will adjust a little bit depending on the volatility of the market at that given point when the portfolio resets.
If there's effectively zero volatility in the markets, you know, maybe something like we saw in 2017, is it possible that upside cap comes down, you know, so significantly that it becomes a problem?
I don't think it would ever become a problem. There's, I think really we saw over this last bull market that we've had, we saw some of the least amount of volatility and just an upward trending market. And originally when these products came to market, the caps were, you know, for the 30% were around, you know, like 8%, and for the 15% buffer, they were more like around, you know, about the same 8 or 9%. And then for the 9% buffer, they were more in like the 10 to 12% range. And so we've actually seen them move up substantially over the period. And but I think those rates that we saw initially when we introduced the initial suite of funds was about as low as we would see. And historically, we've been able to look back at the history of the caps and find that that's really pretty low, and that we're actually more in kind of an average period right now where the caps are at this point. So I think we would expect to see them stay in this range going forward.
Our guest is Bruce Bond, CEO of Innovator ETFs. We're spotlighting the Innovator Defined Outcome ETFs. Bruce, you began alluding to this a bit earlier, but from an investor education perspective, one of the things I worry about with these products is investors purchasing them somewhere during the outcome period, right? So let's say stocks have declined 10% and an investor purchases the 15% power buffer ETF. I guess the question is, do you worry that someone may think they still have 15% protection to the downside when in fact they only have 5%?
I do worry about that, to be honest with you, Nate, and that's the reason we appreciate you having us on the program, an opportunity to talk to people about it, to make sure they're educated, you know, on exactly how the products work. I think the important thing is for anyone who is going to buy after the initial offering day is to go to the website or to secure a rate sheet from us to understand exactly what they're buying at a given price. And so people need to understand that obviously if you buy and the market's down, you know, 15%, you know, you're not going to have the amount of protection in the 15% buffer as you did at the very beginning. Now the you probably would likely have some buffer left, but not nearly 15%. But if you go to the website and look at it, it will tell you, well, you've got 8% left or 9% left or something in this range. I think the great thing, though, is if you do buy it and you understand up front exactly when you're getting in and what your opportunity is, on a go-forward basis, if you let that asset stay within the funds, they will reset on the exact date that you want them to, and the options will expire and continue to roll over and deliver the outcome that you're hoping for, and so you will be provided a 9% buffer on an ongoing basis with whatever cap the market will deliver to you, or a 15% or a 30% buffer with the caps provided by the market at that given time.
Bruce, assuming investors fully understand their upside cap and downside buffer, which again you have on the website, look, these products sound great, right? They're pretty straightforward if you look under the hood. Are there any hidden risks or other surprises here, things that may happen that could cause some sort of an issue for these ETFs?
No, I really don't think so. 3.5 million shares on the first day that the January funds were listed. And so, you know, it's a normal, you know, it's a good amount of volume for an initial listing. And so I think with new products like this, you always want to be careful when you go in and purchase. And what we typically recommend is, you know, right when the market opens and right when the market closes, you want to avoid those two periods if you can, and you want to use a limit order to buy them. Understand what price you're willing to purchase at and put a limit order in. And so that would be the only thing that I would just urge people that are interested in investing is to understand the product well and what their outcome will be. And then secondly, when they go to purchase, to just understand how to put in a limit order and what price to put it in at. Other than that, you know, the great thing about these products is that for anyone who's familiar with, like, you know, structured products or annuities, these types of products, these ETFs, because of the structure, remove many of the obstacles in these older structures and actually make them much more efficient to participate in.
Bruce, I don't want to get too far into the weeds. We have about 2 minutes left here. Is there anything unique about the creation redemption process here, or the ability of authorized participants to keep the ETF share prices in line with net asset value, or is that process pretty straightforward?
That process is pretty straightforward too. It's not dissimilar than a bond ETF. These creates are done in cash, so the cash comes in a create. We purchase the options basket, and I think the interesting thing is sometimes there's you know, people think there's a lot of voodoo around options and what's actually happening because they're not so familiar with them. But really, you know, the basket that we set at the beginning of the options that are going to be the options we're going to use going forward are the same ones we purchase all through the period. And it's like a basket of tech stocks. You know, these are the tech stocks we're going to buy for this particular portfolio through the period, and you just keep buying them through the period. So it's actually very straightforward. Because they are in the S&P 500 index options, these are among the most liquid securities in the world, with over, you know, $1 trillion in open interest in these securities each day. So it's tremendously liquid. The spreads on the funds are actually pretty tight. I did mention, you know, be careful when you put a trade in, but, you know, the spreads are tight for what they are. And, you know, there really aren't a lot of risks when it comes to the creation redemption process.
Well, Bruce, we're out of time. Really appreciate you joining us today. Congratulations on the launch of this lineup. I was looking over the weekend and saw that the 9 ETFs under this series already have nearly $300 million in assets. So these are clearly resonating with investors. We wish you all the best and hope to chat again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was Bruce Bond, CEO of Innovator ETFs. And look, the biggest key with those products, as Bruce mentioned, go to their website before buying. Make sure you understand the upside cap and the downside buffer at the time you actually buy. But as I was saying earlier, you talk about ETF innovation. I think these have to be right up at the top of the list. And I do think it'll be interesting to see if they can disrupt the traditional annuity space at all. All right, the last conversation we have is with Jill Delsignore, head of ETF distribution at J.P. Morgan Asset Management. J.P. Morgan was probably the ETF story of the year last year. About $16 billion of their $21 billion in assets overall came in during 2018. They finished in the top four of ETF flows overall. I really enjoyed this discussion. We covered a lot of ground. We talked about an organization Jill is co-president of, Women in ETFs. We spotlighted a couple of J.P. Morgan actively managed bond ETFs and talked about the potential value of active management and fixed income. And then as it turns out, Jill joined us the day before J.P. Morgan launched what is currently the lowest cost ETF on the market, the Beta Builders U.S. Equity ETF, which costs 2 basis points or $2 for every $10,000 invested. So, of course, we talked ETF fees as well. Jill was great here. Take a listen. Before we talk J.P. Morgan ETFs, I did want to ask you, I saw last week Women in ETFs, which is an organization you are co-president of, they rang the opening bell at IEX, the New York Stock Exchange, I think several other exchanges as well, in celebration of International Women's Day and promoting gender equality. If you don't mind, I'd love to hear more about that and perhaps some background on Women in ETFs.
Absolutely. It's an organization I am so proud to be able to represent, to lead, and to have been involved since the very beginning. So you mentioned the bell rings. It's something we've done now for 5 years. We started just with what at the time seemed big, but now when you think about the fact that this year we did over 80 bells around the globe, you know, in our first year we did just around 10 to 12 bells. And so we've really grown in an effort to really bring a light onto gender inequality and see what we can do to try to help change that. Now, the organization, you know, like I mentioned, I was one of the original members back. We just celebrated our 5-year anniversary. In fact, when you and I ran into one another in Florida, it was right after we were hosting our 5-year anniversary breakfast, which we do every year at Inside ETFs, thanks to the partnership of Inside ETFs. And, you know, we originally looked at as a way to connect the industry. You know, some of us that were there at the beginning were involved in other organizations within financial services, whether it was 100 Women in Hedge Funds or, you know, other financial services organizations. But there was nothing that we could find within the ETF industry. And so we got together and started to think, how is there a way that we can kick this off? And so at Inside ETFs, back in 2014, we actually hosted a breakfast with less than 100 women and actually two men at that conference. And now I'm proud to say that membership has crossed nearly 5,000 women and men across the globe. And this year's breakfast last month, which I had the honor of kicking off, had over 400 women and about 300 women and about 100 men. So it's been really exciting to see the growth of the organization.
Jill, I'm curious from your perspective, how big of an issue is gender inequality in the asset management and I guess the overall financial services space?
Yeah, so I'll speak more broadly. I came across some statistics in preparation for hosting the IEX Bell on Friday. And there were some stats that were a little bit eye-opening, a lot of eye-opening to me, frankly, and that's that we actually had lost ground last year, dropping 25% in the number of female CEOs that we have at Fortune 500 companies. You know, at this rate, broadly speaking, it won't be for over 100 years that we actually close the gender gap. Another stat that got me was that women have as much access to financial services as men in only 60% of the countries around the world. So we have a lot of work to do. But if we take a light and we shine it on the ETF industry specifically, which is what we're doing within Women in ETFs, we actually do see a significant number of women in leadership roles within our specific industry. If you think about it, as the industry has grown over the last decade, two decades, there have been women that have come in and been able to grow up with the industry and as a result have been able to take on leadership roles. Myself, as a prime example, as the industry has grown, I have grown with it over the last decade and been able to now be in a leadership role. And it's been exciting to see my peers do the same. But one thing that's interesting and we're trying to address, is that one thing we did recognize as a gap, despite the women in leadership and broadly in the industry, frankly, within ETFs, there was an underrepresentation of women on panels. I know you moderated down at Inside ETFs. There was a broad underrepresentation on panels and in speaking positions at major industry conferences. So about a year ago, we launched the Speakers Bureau. And so we're working with Inside ETFs, IMN, Morningstar, to try to solve for that. And we have a very, I think, novel goal of getting to a 25% representation by women on panels at these industry conferences by next year, by 2020. So hopefully by the time I see you next year in Florida, we'll have exceeded that goal.
Yeah, what a fantastic organization. If people want to learn more about this or getting involved, where should they go?
Definitely. It's womeninetfs.com, and we have chapters all over the world. Here in the U.S., which I imagine most of your audience is from, we have chapters from the West Coast in San Francisco, Denver, Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., New York, and Boston.
Our guest is Jill DelSignore, head of ETF distribution with J.P. Morgan's asset management business. All right, Jill, so we're going to look at a couple of J.P. Morgan bond ETFs today. And let's start with the J.P. Morgan Core Plus Bond ETF, ticker symbol JCPB. This just launched at the end of January. It is actively managed. What was the rationale behind launching this ETF? And then tell us what the investment goal is here.
Yeah, so one of the key tenets, if we sort of take a step back and look from a sort of a 20,000-foot view of J.P. Morgan's product development strategy, I think you did such an excellent job, thank you, on the front end, sort of introducing what we're doing. You know, we've been really proud of the fact that we've been able to build out a lineup that leverages existing J.P. Morgan capabilities, even down to our beta builder suite. We have enormous capability within market cap-weighted beta index management at J.P. Morgan, although most folks don't know that. So we've built it out across equities, fixed income, and alternatives, and then across factor-based, purely active, and purely indexed. And one of the things we're trying to do, and one of the key tenets around that strategy, is to provide choice to ETF investors. And one area where we see and continue to see room for more choice is in fixed income. So if we look at JCPB specifically, it's about how the ag has changed. And we can apply that to some other products in our fixed income lineup, but specifically at JCPB, if you look at the ag, right, I think a lot of folks haven't recognized how the ag has changed. You know, it's a rules-based index, as most of us know, and it's based on the amount of debt an issuer has. So the more indebted the borrower, the higher the weighting they have in the index, very similar to what we see with market cap weighting in equities. Well, with quantitative easing, it's influenced debt issuance and frankly, weakened the ag's risk-return profile, leaving it really concentrated in U.S. Treasuries and, frankly, less diversified across sectors and more sensitive to rising rates. So in conversations with clients, many have been reassessing how closely they're going to tie themselves to fixed income. How closely they're going to tie their fixed income assets to the ag. And they're really looking to alternatives to loosen those constraints and allow for more flexibility. And so JCPB has been a great solution to that, as has JPSC, which I think we'll talk about shortly. But if you look at JCPB, you know, it's an ETF, actively managed ETF, to your point, that's managed by our GFIC team, so Global Fixed Income Currency and Commodity Team. That is a very broad platform that manages nearly $500 billion in assets. And so we're leveraging that platform, that vertical, that's over almost 300, you know, investment professionals across the world. They manage a similar portfolio that has a 26-year track record. So to be able to take that, leverage that expertise, and bring it into the ETF industry, it's a way that we can show how we're able to bring J.P. Morgan's expertise, proven expertise, into the ETF industry. So it's a way for our investors, our clients, who are looking for a way to look outside of the ag, to combine kind of this research-driven security selection process, bottom-up, if you will, with a top-down macro overlay to give them a very diversified portfolio across sectors, durations, yield curves, et cetera. So we're excited to be able to bring that to the industry. Like you said, it launched at the end of January.
Jill, you mentioned JPST, which is the ultra-short income ETF. This is approaching $6 billion in assets.
Yeah.
It's been a huge success story. This one, as you mentioned, is also actively managed. Tell us more about that ETF.
Yeah, you know, we are so excited. People talk about, you talked about at the beginning of the podcast, you know, the success we had last year. And I'm so excited that we were able to have that success across the platform, right, in our factor-based products, in active fixed income, and in beta builders. And with an active fixed income, it was so driven by JPST. So we raised the fund, launched in May of 2017, so not even 2 years old, and during the course of last year raised over $5 billion in assets. This is a similar story to what I just talked about with JCPB, leveraging an existing vertical at JP Morgan. So we have a $600 billion global liquidity team, and we were able to leverage them to manage this portfolio. If you look in the industry, a lot of folks are using a kind of a bond team to come down the curve and manage these ultra short products. We instead are taking a global liquidity team and having them come out a little bit to manage this portfolio. So it's been an incredibly exciting story for us, particularly as our clients, anecdotally in conversations, are saying they want to look at options to bring in duration. And so it's been a terrific solution for all sorts of investors. As you can appreciate, Nate, you know, products start off and you sort of have the retail audience that are buying them, and then they start to get size, and then they become very interesting to institutions. And that's exactly what we've seen with JPST, where it started off as a retail solution, and it remains a huge retail solution, but we've had more and more institutional investors come into the product as well, which is exciting for us and has continued to accelerate the growth.
Jill, as I know you're well aware, for better or worse, we continue to see this active versus passive debate continue to rage on, right? And the track record for active, I would say, hasn't been great on the equity side. It has been better in fixed income. Any additional thoughts here for an investor trying to decide between active and passive strategies in their bond portfolios? You mentioned some of the potential limitations of the ag, but any further thoughts on active versus passive?
Yeah, I think for us, it's not about active or passive. It's about active and passive. Right, and what is that client trying to achieve? I think there's options across the spectrum. But if we were to look at active fixed income in the ETF wrapper specifically, I think to your point, we haven't seen as much success. I think primarily due to lack of product, right, in active equity. And that landscape could change, you know, over the course of time. But right now, if you look at the landscape of the active management in fixed income, we've seen strong demand for active management in fixed income because it's been shown in a lot of cases that managers can outperform. There's over $3 trillion in active strategies across ETFs and mutual funds. Obviously, the bulk of that is in mutual funds. There's $1.2 trillion in passive or debtor-weighted, you know, the ag, if you will, debtor-weighted equity, or I'm sorry, fixed income indexes. And ETFs have been the beneficiary of the bulk of those passive flows, primarily because of the limited active options. And so that's changing. And even if you just point to last year at the success that we've seen across active ETFs, obviously JPST contributing meaningfully to that, I think we're going to continue to see that as we see more and more product come into that space, because investors have been telling us via their flows that they do like active management and fixed income. There's just been a lack of choice. So we kind of go back to the beginning where we started, and I said we're looking to really fill white space where we see opportunity to provide more choice.
And putting the active versus passive debate aside, what do you think are some of the most important considerations right now for investors in terms of managing their bond portfolio, just as you look at the overall bond environment right now?
Yeah. So we actually, in an effort to help advisors have a really simple framework to how to think about fixed income portfolio construction, because we know it can be really challenging, especially in environments like this one. We worked years ago to create a simple framework for fixed income portfolio construction. We call it the fixed income triangle, and it really has three parts. You have the core strategies, which, you know, kind of give you duration exposure and help insulate a portfolio from equity pullbacks. Think about in the context of this conversation, JCPB. We have the core complement strategies, so those are designed to mitigate inflation risk. Think JPST in this conversation. And then extended sector strategies, and we didn't talk about any in the course of our conversation yet today, but that's strategies that are reaching for more total return. Think high yield, emerging market debt. In the case of JP Morgan, we have our Global Bond Opportunity Fund as example. And so we work with clients to really understand, based on what they're trying to achieve for their clients, what they should be investing in across all of those pieces of the triangle so that they can overweight or underweight really what they're trying to do in a portfolio. And taking it a step further, we actually have a team here at the firm called our Portfolio Insights Team. And we work, whether it's just on fixed income portfolios or broadly an entire portfolio for advisors, to take a look and do a diagnostic of their portfolio to say, all right, you're overweighted to high yield, or you're overweighted, in the case of equities, you're overweighted to the quality factor or the momentum factor, and what would happen if we were to add this ETF or that fund. And so it really allows us to have a robust discussion with our clients about what's going to be the best portfolio for them and what they're trying to build for their clients.
All right, Joe, we have about 2 minutes left, and switching gears a bit, I have to ask you, and you probably know this is coming, but tomorrow J.P. Morgan is launching the Beta Builders U.S. Equity ETF, ticker symbol BBUS. This will be the lowest cost ETF on the market, 2 basis points. Now, there had been some speculation this could be launched with a zero fee, and I know you can't comment on this until after the launch, but I guess I'd just love to hear your thoughts on the overall fee landscape right now. We continue to see ETF fee cuts. We did see filings for zero fee ETFs after waivers from another provider. That was a couple of weeks ago. We're seeing more commission-free ETF trading. How do you view all this from your perch?
Absolutely. So, you know, fee pressure continues in our industry, right? They continue to get driven down. Clearly, we are bringing products to market that are lower cost, we believe competitively priced for the exposure that they're providing. And that's not exclusive to the beta builders, right? We have single factors that are offered at 12 basis points and JPST at 18. So we certainly understand that fees matter to our clients. And at the end of the day, lower fees translate to better outcomes for our clients. And so we understand that providing inexpensive building blocks, whether that's beta builders or JPST, the single factors, you know, a whole suite of products across our lineup, are important, and we want to continue to try to meet that client demand. So to your point, you know, I'm not involved in pricing decisions, and you can't speak prior to the fund being launched, so I can't really comment on how we end up there. But I do know that we're incredibly excited to be able to provide these types of exposures to our clients at very competitive costs.
Well, Joe, with that, we'll have to leave it there. Always a pleasure. Really appreciated your time today. Thank you.
Absolutely, Nate. Thank you so much.
So that was Jill Del Signor, head of ETF distribution with J.P. Morgan's asset management business. And her comment on fees at the end there, she mentioned fee pressure continues across the ETF landscape. This has obviously been a huge story just over the past month. We've seen fee cuts from Vanguard, Schwab, State Street. We saw SoFi filing for the first free ETFs, Salt Financial with negative fee ETFs. Now, it's not clear what the end game is in all this, but we do know costs continue to get driven down. And as Jill said, at the most basic level, lower fees do translate to better investment outcomes. Jason, by the way, to tie this back to the earlier conversation we played with Dave Nottig, I can't help but think back to Jack Bogle. He has to be smiling down on all of this. He was the one who, I guess you could say, fired the first shot in the fee war, what, some 40 plus years ago?
It's such an amazing transition over the years. Step back from the tree and take a look at the forest or the timeline. Just 20 or 30 years ago, you're right, people were satisfied to pay well north of 1% per year for oftentimes just a closet index fund, you know, just mirroring the S&P for, you know, a hefty bill. You know, we move forward to recent times and there's a little clamor, some commentary about expenses, you know, generally speaking, moving south of 1%, you know, 70, 80, 90 bips. You know, here we are and pundits are shouting from the mountaintop that we're reducing fees from 10 or 20 bips to 2 or 3 bips. And yes, that's important. And yes, that is great for the investor. But I think we have to also recognize that as we continue down this road to free ETFs, to ETFs that pay you to invest, the marginal benefit of having that cost, you know, that fixture on cost is really decreasing. And we need to keep our eye on the ball and recognize that there's other factors that are going to become more and more important as a percentage of your attention span onto what makes a difference.
I think that is an excellent point. Look, we talk about the importance of costs all the time. We wave that cost banner. But the fact is, as costs have continued to come down, they actually become less important. And you have to look under the hood of what the ETF actually owns. What's the right fit in your portfolio? Cost isn't everything. And, you know, something else that I'll mention is with fees coming down to zero or negative, there is a lot of talk about what's the catch. If I'm getting something for free, there has to be you know, the fund companies have to make money somewhere. And so I do worry a little bit the conversation has shifted there. How are fund companies making money if they're offering me something for free?
Well, when you make that point, I think of social media in today's landscape, you know, Facebook and Twitter and all of these tremendous services that you can use for free, but they're not free. There's a product and there's a price. And what you need to understand is the product is you and the information and data you're willing to share for free for the benefit of the service. Now, is that a direct translation to the investment world? I don't know, but it's certainly something to think about.
Well, no, I think the biggest key there is just you have to keep your radar up. If costs are down to near zero, you have to know fund companies make money somewhere. So just pay attention to everything that you're paying. What's the interest that you're getting in your sweep account and, you know, those sorts of things. So this will continue to be a big point of discussion. All right. Hope you enjoyed this week's Best of ETF Prime. Podcasts are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, iTunes, and Spotify. You can follow me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. Next week, we have two really interesting guests for you. We'll first be joined by John Davey, founder and chief investment officer at Astoria Portfolio Advisors, who's an ETF strategist. So we're going to visit with John about the current market environment and some ETFs he's watching. We'll also put John through our rapid-fire ETF Q&A. And then market graders Carlos Diaz will spotlight the index behind the Barron's 400 ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.